Verzeihung? Verzeihung?
Christofferson? Hallo? Kannst du uns hören? Christofferson?
Sie haben den Jungen.
Euch recht herzlich zur Juli-Ausgabe des Marinaden-Podcasts. Die heutige Marinade widmen wir Olga. Für die Marinade benötigt ihr 200 Milliliter Wasser, 100 Gramm rote Beete, 2 Äpfel, eine große Zwiebel, grobes Meersalz und schwarze Pfefferkörner. Im ersten Schritt zerschneidet ihr die rote Beete in 4 große Stücke. Die Äpfel werden in jeweils 8 Teile zerkleinert und zu der roten Beete gegeben. Anschließend werden die Zwiebeln in kleine Würfel zerhackt. Das Ganze in einen Topf geben, mit grobem Meersalz und Pfefferkörnern abschmecken und 200 ml Wasser dazugeben. Das Wasser nun zum Aufkochen bringen und bei niedriger Temperatur 20 Minuten ziehen lassen. Im letzten Schritt gebt ihr die Marinade zu dem Fleisch und stellt das Ganze für 24 Stunden in den Kühlschrank.
Tagesanbruch. Wir sind in einer Stadt.
In welcher?
Keine Ahnung. Das klingen mag, aber wir sind auf einem Larvenboot in den Krieg gefahren. Das hatte die Armee irgendwo gemietet und in den Larven gebracht. Was weiß ich. Damit wollten sie sich halt überwinden.
On Asheville FM 103.3 LPFM in Asheville, this is the Final Straw Radio, a weekly anarchist and anti-authoritarian broadcast and podcast emanating out of occupied Chalagi land in southern Appalachia. We bring you voices and perspectives from projects and struggles all around the world, and you can find our archives, transcripts, ways to follow us and support us at thefinalstrawradio.noblogs.org. In this episode, we have two segments. First up, Ian talks with Philadelphia-based cartoonist Ben Passmore about his new book, Black Arms to Hold You Up, A History of Black Resistance. They discuss the research and making of the book, Passmore's anarchism, the themes of intergenerational struggle, contextualizing history through lived experience, and the pitfalls of myth-making. In addition, they spend some time discussing Ben's martial arts practice and the legacy of Assata Shakur in light of her recent passing. Then we'll hear a brief interview with Mykola Diadok, a Belarusian journalist, anarchist activist, blogger, and former political prisoner. Mikola is now about 3 months out of prison and starting a new life in exile. The interview was conducted in mid-November 2025 by comrades from Frequence Ah and appears in the December 2025 episode of Bad News, Angry Voices from Around the World from the A Radio Network. Check out more of those episodes at a-radio-network.org, and you can find in the show notes a link to Frequenza's work and ways to support him in his new life.
Okay, we're here today talking with Ben Passmore about his new book, Black Arms to Hold You Up, out from Pantheon Press. Ben, can you introduce yourself to listeners and maybe talk about your pronouns and any affiliations you think may be relevant to our conversation?
Oh, sure, yeah. I'm Ben Passmore, he, him. No formal institutional affiliations, being an anarchist or whatever. I am loosely affiliated with Kupangana Ngumi, which is a Pan-African martial arts and study event, and the Neighborhood Martial Arts Project. I go in and out of being the striking coach over there.
Okay, thank you very much for that. My first interest is in comics. So I wonder if you could maybe talk a little bit about how you found your way to illustration and comics and cartooning.
Oh, yeah. I think for people around my age, nerds around my age, which is 42, I got into comics as a kid during comics' like grim dark era, you know, lots of spikes, lots of leather vests. The first comic for adults that I got into was Spawn, that my babysitter passed to me as like, one blurred, recognizing an emerging blurred. So he gave me a bunch of video games and some Spawn comics. So that sort of kicked off my love for it. I read like Peanuts and Garfield and Calvin and Hobbes when I was a kid, but Spawn really made me want to draw. And I used to just spend a lot of time in my room trying to redraw panels from the Spawn comic. All those little chains and spikes and stuff. So that's kind of where it started for me.
And did that precede finding your way to politics?
Yeah, most definitely. I was slightly precocious politically as a kid, but I was mostly just like a little criminal, which depending on who you ask, was not being particularly very political. I didn't get super locked into any kind of politics at all until I was a teenager. I got sent to a troubled teen school, which people are pretty familiar with now. I caught a felony for a possession of stolen property, and I ended up in the school for more or less like four and a half years. In the library, they had pretty randomly this book called Look Out Whitey, Because Black Power is Coming to Get Your Mama, by Julius Lester. And that is a book that is about, no one would be surprised to hear, the history of Black Power. And that sort of kicked it off for me. I got into Marcus Garvey shortly after that. I read some of Cornel West's book, all while I was at the school. And that gave me a bit more context for American history.
As an aside, have you written a cartoon about that experience?
In this book, I refer to it a bit, trying to contextualize sort of the reason why I was tackling this particular history, the Black radical tradition or, Black liberation in general. But no, I've never written really at all about my time in reform school, although, I've been thinking about it.
I enjoyed this book very much. It was my first exposure to your work, and I, subsequently went back and got into the other stuff, and I enjoyed that as well. Can you talk about the genesis of this book? How long was it in the making, and how it kind of changed over the course of its production?
Yeah. Thanks for that question. Well, there's a couple different answers to it. Some are sort of like a little more inspiring than the others. I usually like to just, mention them both. Well, let's see. I had been somewhere going back to the Black radical tradition, maybe about like 7 years ago or more. I had been, radicalized by it as a kid. And then when I got out of reform school, I went to college. I got connected with anarchists and got put onto anarchism. And a lot of my first sort of like praxis stuff, like things I was actually doing outside of just like reading things, was with anarchists. And within that milieu, there was a lot of skepticism of like the Panthers and certain aspects of Black radical history. You know, at least at the time, anarchists tend to be a lot more interested in the BLA, if anything, you know. And so I sort of pushed off like the Black radical tradition as an area of focus and inspiration for me. And then maybe around like Ferguson in particular, I found myself feeling a little burnt out by a mostly white anarchist milieu and feeling like I'd run aground on a lot of different ways that I had been approaching things. So I started just kind of going back. And I, you know, that's happened to me at different times in my life where I'll just go back to the Black radical tradition and start studying things. And I found this book called Black Power Reconsidered. And it was about, it was an anthology by a bunch of rank and file Panthers. I don't think there was any, you know, no one wrote in it that was part of the Central Committee or anything. And they were really focused on talking about their experiences in the party as now grownups, you know, because most of the Panthers were very young, and talking about sort of misconceptions that surrounded the party itself. And that I appreciated the reflection. It was very different from like the hyper romanticized view that I've been used to. And over time, I just, you know, I was studying more and more, I was reading more and more, I got more connected in my personal life with a lot more nationalists, a lot more Pan-Africanists. They became part of my friend group. And, you know, I mentioned Kupin and Ghana and Gumi. I do some projects now with people that are Pan-Africanists. So that was happening in my life, and my life was changing, you know, me trying to sort of address the contradictions between my anarchism and a kind of growing nationalism, or at least a sympathy for it. And then 2020 hit, and around that time, and this is the sort of non-romantic part of the story, my agent was asking me, you know, what I wanted to pitch. He was like, you know, it's maybe a good time for you to pitch a book and get out of your, you know, indie comics world stuff. And his initial suggestions were things I didn't want to do were sort of like, you know, how to be an activist and some, you know, something like that, which I didn't want to do anything like that. But I said, I was like, well, you know, the way that I've learned how to do a lot of what I, you know, I do in my life is through, you know, studying these people and their contexts and, you know, both the things that are really exciting and the things that are not so exciting, you know, learning from people's successes and failures. So I more or less suggested that we pitch a book that was, you know, covering about 100 years of history. And you know, more or less that's how we got here. The book itself, I signed the contract in 2020. So, you know, on the books is about 5 years, but I started researching before that. So overall, the book took about like 7 years, and the drawing section probably took about a year and a half, 2 years.
So if I could maybe go back to the beginning of your answer here, reading about rank and file Black Panthers, it's kind of, I'm trying to think of how to phrase this. You're getting the story without all of the myth making, is my impression. And I wonder, it sounds like that was very valuable, but I mean, I wonder if you could maybe drill down a little bit further and maybe talk about what in particular the value of that was, if you indeed did find it valuable.
Yeah. Well, I think that there is this overall tendency within, you know, whatever you want to consider the left, there's this tendency to be really wedded to romantic aspects of struggle. Like even outside of this, you know, Black liberation stuff, I remember being a younger anarchist and reading all these like crime think books and, you know, thinking that like, oh, you know, this is all good. This is all positives. You know, I'm a feel like anarchist Rambo. And then, you know, a bunch of years later being like, well, I actually have a whole lot of PTSD from running around in these streets, you know?
Right.
And I understand why maybe that isn't addressed, but I think it made it difficult for me to understand, you know, that I was being traumatized by certain things and also think about how to how to address it. You know, there was a whole lot of shame that I carried for a while, feeling, you know, like negatively impacted by things that make sense. You know, you get choked out by a cop, or, you know, like you get attacked by a Klan member. Like these are traumatizing things, you know? So I think sort of similarly, Panthers that have tried to reflect in a very clear-eyed way about, you know, what was both good and not so good about the party and their personal experiences, and also what they, you know, what they think they would like to see sort of approached differently in future generations, trying to sort of apply these ideas. I think it just gives you tools. It gives you tools for, you know, how to recognize abuses of power. You know, Assata Shakur wrote a whole lot about how patriarchy contributed to just a lack of a cohesion in the party. Ashanti Alston also talks about that quite a bit. But also, like, you know, lesser known figures like Safia Bukhari, who was in the BLA and in the Republic of New Africa, wrote quite a bit about her experiences in both the party and in the BLA and the long-term effects and reflections of those things. So I think one of the valuable experiences, or like the valuable tools that I got from anarchists, Milieu specifically, was just a practical, this tendency to read theory and history in order to apply it. You know, you're trying to come away with tools. You know, it's not so much, or at least in the milieus I was in, it was not so much about being like rah-rah about the things you're reading and sort of make, you know, like role models out of the people we're reading about. You know what I mean? Obviously, people like Ashanti Alston should be, you know what I mean, respected and appreciated. Sure. But even he himself would be like, you know, I'm not a hero, I'm a comrade, I'm out here, I'm still learning. So I think for me, books like Black Panther Reconsidered, it was very similar. The way that most people wrote about it, they were like, we should always understand as ourselves as people who are changing, who are evolving, and rather than thinking of that time or ourselves as mythical figures. There's also the book Comrades too, which is rank and file members who are also writing about it in that way. I think in my experience, if I can be messy, I think honestly, like most Panthers I've interacted with interpersonally speak about the party in that way, you know, trying to talk about, you know, where they saw, outside of COINTELPRO, ways that the party itself or members in it contributed to the dissolution of the party. It's in my experience, it's more central committee members or people who are like maybe not even really in the party for real, who seem to be really obsessed with myth making, like interpersonally, you know what I mean? In conversation, won't cop to any sort of like shortcomings, you know?
Thank you for that. So I read this book in conversation with a lot of, you know, the quote unquote graphic histories of recent years that I feel sought to encapsulate histories of social movements into more digestible graphic narratives, probably for people who are like wholly unfamiliar with them. So I think that you maybe know like the kind that I'm talking about, the kind that you kind of would see, you know, in not necessarily a radical bookstore, but maybe a more mainstream bookstore, for instance. Mm-hmm. So what do you think the pros and cons of those books are? And do you see Black Arms to Hold You Up as a repudiation of that format or more of an addition to that canon?
Yeah. Well, I think, and I do think I know what you're talking about. I mean, there's an enormous, outside of political subjects, there's just a huge market now for nonfiction histories, you know? So, you know, I think there was a time when there wasn't a clear market. You know, I think all of us, you know, at least in the United States who are producing nonfiction comics of this type are responding to maybe our two gods, our Art Spiegelman and Joe Sacco, both who produced those books when there wasn't, well, I mean, Art Spiegelman, we have the term graphic novel because of his publicist, sure. You know?
Right.
So I think, you know, particularly from an anarchist perspective, like story writing is like an inherently flawed way to sort of approach the way that we want to talk about social movements. Because the easiest thing in the world is to pick a singular person and sort of drape, you know, all, you know, everything that happens around this person, you know, and then, you know, before you know it, for lack of an easier sort of narrative of a device, you've created like, you know, some great man, you know. So I think it's always tricky because you only have so much space, and you know, this, you know, comic books can be a difficult way to sort of like capture a lot of detail. You know what I mean? I think in this book, I wouldn't say that I was repudiating.
Please take your time and what? You have some suggestions, okay?
Weihnachten. Sinterklaas, Sinterklaas wäre ich ein kleines bisschen früher. Das ist herzlich willkommen beim Stimmungsradio 88.3 Walkers Amsterdam. Der 24.12.2009. Bisweilen wünsche ich mir Bonnie Rennsteig, Geburtstag in Rostock, irgendwo in betreuten Wohnen. Herzlichen Glückwunsch und die Stimmungsleute sollen natürlich auch nicht ohne ausgehen. Oi! Fuck, mein Alter, das ist dann Bonnie Rennsteig, weil ich voll geil. Weil ich dann fällt das fucking Ding an, aber ist der nicht so cool. And I'd say to me, hey, his friends, when you finish what's up here, want to say something? Are you ready? We are ready all the time, man. We are born ready.
On your skin, I want to play the game, and I don't care about anything. So for tonight, let's have some fun. Show me how to use this gun. Kill me again, and when it's done, we'll run into the morning sun. So for tonight, let's have some fun. Show me how to use this gun. Kill me again, and when it's done, we'll run into the morning sun. Rush, rush, let's get on the ride. But as I see the flames reflecting on your skin, I want to play the game, and I don't care about anything. So for tonight, let's have some fun. Show me how to use this gun. Kill me again, and when it's done, we'll run into the morning sun. So for tonight, let's have some fun. Show me how to use this gun. Kill me again, and when it's done, we'll run into the morning sun. I want to play the game.
das hier nur noch mal zum Ausplanen der Aufnahme. Ich weiß gar nicht, ob man es mitgekriegt hat.
Apocalypse 2012. strange than we think. I think these swifts, they live 5 times faster than us. You know, they actually live, they perceive things 5 times a rate. They move so much faster than us. 5 or 10 times faster. We must be like cold statues, like slow-moving number of creatures, and they're moving so gracefully.
Wow, I've been told that there's over 1 million swifts living in these waterfalls. Can that be true?
Yeah, they're all awesome.
Why do they live behind the falls, do you think? Why do they go there?
Falls are some kind of big density or big
kingdom. Yeah, secret kingdom. It's like a big concert. They just, like, shoals of fish. Suddenly they just move, dive down all together, and it moves backwards and forwards. It's like there's some sort of music controlling you. We heard exploring up them and suddenly they all decide to shoot. They never will. Look, here they come!
fortunate enough to witness something of the gem. I'm a minor marine mostly. This is like a diamond. Nice big diamond. Yeah, look, this is gold. This is real gold. There is this big white diamond just floating around in the sunrise. It's good. Yeah, I dedicate this to my mom somewhere in Spain. A lot of think of this. Yeah, this is beautiful. Mistress Enid Abbott.
Just think about it for a second. Think about the fact you've got 7,900 miles of rock below you right now. Wherever you're sitting on the planet, you've got 7,900 miles of rock. Try to imagine that huge amount of rock. You go, oh, I jump! Gravity is a force that pulls me down. You can't escape it unless you have something like a helium balloon or wings like those Swifts. Those Swifts have got a lovely Latin name, Aeronautis. Isn't that a beautiful name, the way they dive down in their free flight, becoming weightless before they dip into those falls. Isn't that beautiful?
Out of curiosity, our physician on location, an expert mountain climber, decided to have a look for himself. He wanted to see the mysterious nesting place of the Swifts. From the bottom of the falls, the gigantic cave is inaccessible and has resisted all attempts by explorers. We lower the camera to him, hoping to gaze into the unknown. Later, we decided not to show his footage. We will show only the image from the spinning camera as we pulled it back up on a rope.
Am Anfang und einem Gefühl von tiefem Raum, der in einem schwarzen Nichts endet, wenn man da dahinter kommt.
Ich bin sicher, du warst der Erste, der das je gesehen hat.